We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
They're gonna kill the love of my life.
Casey!
If I don't go back to what I was doing.
This Friday.
Our line of work is quite brutal and quite ruthless.
How far would you go for love?
You steal a truck, bring it to me. Then you make your money.
Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous!
Nicholas Holt, Felicity Jones, with Ben Kingsley and Anthony Hopkins.
All this trouble, all this pain, for love.
Collide, in theaters Friday. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Welcome to the RotoWire Fantasy Football Podcast, brought to you by DraftKings.com, the leader in daily fantasy sports. You can use the promo code RotoWire, that's R-O-T-O-W-I-R-E, when you deposit on DraftKings. That'll get you a free contest entry today. It is Monday, November 16th, the year 2015. Nick Whalen here, as I always am on Mondays, with RotoWire's Derek Van Riper. Derek will be breaking down Week 10 in the NFL, a week with no shortage of upsets, and I guess we can dive right into it. Maybe the most shocking result in Week 10, especially in this part of the country, was Detroit 18, Green Bay just 16 points, and Detroit's first win in Lambeau since 1991, I believe.
Yeah, 1991. I think I was 7 years old last time that happened.
I was like -1 years old.
Yeah, -1 is a good age. I think you can get a lot.
I think I peaked.
You peaked at -1. This game, the Lions kept leaving the door open. I mean, Matt Prater missed a couple of extra points. Kelvin Johnson fumbled an onside kick recovery. Of all people to drop an onside kick catch, I mean, he'd be the person I would want
the least
to catch it.
Like the least likely player I would pick in the entire league to do that.
Yeah, and you're watching this and you're like, okay, this is a horrible streak the Lions are trying to get past. They're going to find a way to lose this game. Like, I've seen this movie so many times before, and I mean, the Packers' offense was just awful. Like, they had a two-point conversion play that would have worked. I think if they had thrown inside, was it Rodgers? I think it was Richard Rodgers ran the inside. They threw to the outside to Adams instead, I want to say.
I think Adams has to make that catch. And, you know, they showed it on replay, and Detroit's cornerback did get a hand in there, and it was a pretty nice play, especially in slow motion. That was evident. But I think a lot of receivers in this league pull that ball in and are able to secure that. That was a problem for him all day. I think Adams, you know, the referees maybe got in his head a little bit early. There was a lot of complaining. Obviously, he drew a penalty for complaining at one point and, you know, justified in some ways. But at the same time, I think it got to the point late in the game where Packers receivers and tight ends seemed to be looking for the call first before attacking the ball. And they did start to get some calls down the stretch, a couple questionable ones maybe to kind of compensate for what had happened earlier in the game. But yeah, just a tough way to end. I think Rodgers had to rush that throw a little bit. Detroit brought the blitz on that two-point conversion. He lofted it up a little bit more than he probably would have wanted to, but still a play that you'd like your receiver to make.
Yeah, I mean, he had his share of drops. I think James Jones at least had one bad one. The receiving core as a whole did not play well in this game, and Rodgers looked a little bit off again. He's just missing throws, which is very uncharacteristic of him. I mean, you could watch him play all season, and there could be a year where he doesn't miss as many throws as he did in that game. At least that's what it felt
and
like.
It was short throws, too. You know, plays, and to his credit, he was being pressured quite a bit. But it's the same story that we've seen over the last couple of weeks. You know, he's bailing on the pocket pretty early, starts to scramble out. And, you know, usually you like Rodgers in those situations. But, you know, 4 or 5 yard check down throws to tight ends to running backs were just falling way short for most of the day.
Well, a lot of Justin Perillo, a little bit of Jared Abradaris in this game. I mean, this
Justin Perillo. Resurrecting Donald Driver's number 80.
Yeah, I wonder how many people took the 80 Driver and just like put the Perillo in masking tape on the back. I mean, that's always
probably
a good
not
look.
Too many.
At least one person somewhere north of where we are recording this podcast has done that.
I was kind of surprised. I don't know. I mean, Donald Driver statistically, you know, is one of the better receivers in Packers history. I don't think he ever quite achieved, you know, he's not going to be a Hall of Famer or anything like that, but I was a little surprised to see a different number 80 out there. Like, this is the first time that anyone has worn it since Driver, right?
Yeah, I think it is, unless somebody had it maybe during the
preseason.
Does he
have any chance of like getting his number retired at some point?
Yeah, Packer Ring of Honor.
I think it could happen.
Well,
he's kind of borderline just because, I mean, he got the Super Bowl. He was so good for so long, but like we said, he never quite reached that elite level.
I mean, if you think about it, they're going to honor Ron Wolf and Brett Favre here in the next couple of weeks, and until they're on there, you can't really even think about guys like Driver. But I think he's really close. I think he's kind of a memorable player from that era because he was the most consistent, I think, of the number one receivers that Favre had during his time in Green Bay. I think based on longevity and production, he was also ultimately was Favre's best target for a long time. So I could see him possibly being in that consideration. And
I think he means a lot to Green Bay too. I think he was kind of the face of that team from the end of the Favre transition into the first couple of years of Rodgers. It was, you know, kind of Driver who was that constant guy, and you know, just somebody who's been present in the community quite a bit. So I think that helps. You know, just being a Packers lifer.
Yeah, well, with Driver too. I mean, he's a great story. Like he was homeless growing up and went on to Alcorn State and was I think a seventh round draft pick who ended up
like that.
Becoming the team's top receiver for a long time. I mean, even above the football achievements, he won Dancing with the Stars season 14. Like that.
I mean, that was huge.
That's probably his greatest accomplishment.
He might have to retire his tuxedo, I think, instead of the number 80.
He probably want to have his dancing shoes up there next to the number 80 if he does get in at some point. All right, I mean, like, look, Donald Driver, yeah, maybe. Maybe he's in the Ring of Honor. I think there's better than a 50% chance he gets in. Like, I'd say he probably does get it, but it's reasonably close. The product on the field right now, all sorts of problems. Offensive line is not blocking very well. The offensive line is not healthy. That's a huge problem. So I'm looking at this, and I'm just wondering, is there any reason to think it's going to get better? I mean, this could be the rock bottom point in the season, and if this is rock bottom, there's nowhere to go but up. You look at the upcoming schedule. They go on the road to Minnesota. They get the Bears at home on Thanksgiving night. They go on the road to Detroit again in just a few weeks. They get Dallas at home, Oakland and Arizona on the road, and Minnesota at home. And the way Minnesota's playing, the way Arizona's playing, the fact that the Cowboys are going to have Romo back, and that Oakland hasn't been terrible at all this year. I mean, they lost yesterday, but they've played well overall. That schedule looks a lot more difficult now than it did just a few weeks ago. Do they win half of those games? I mean, do you see them going through those final seven games and winning four? They go 4-3 the rest of the way? Because they go 4-3, they win 10 games, and they make the playoffs probably as a wild card. Because right now, they're a game behind Minnesota in the division.
Isn't it crazy how the conversation has shifted even over the last week, you know, the last 24 hours? You know, after those losses to Carolina and to Denver, I think there was still the expectation that this was a rough patch. They were going to get through it. You look ahead, you got Detroit, which was supposed to be an easy win to kind of reset everything for this offense after facing two tough defenses. And now we're looking at it like, hey, maybe best case scenario, they can sneak into the playoffs at 10-6. And, you know, the expectations have changed drastically at this point. And I'm interested to see what the line's going to be next week at Minnesota. I mean, are the Vikings going to be favored at home in that game?
They should be.
They should be.
Based on recent form and everything. I mean, like, it'd be a small, it'd be a point or two, but I mean, when's the last time Minnesota was favored against the Packers? Probably at least 4 or 5 years ago, if not longer than that. I mean,
it's been
quite some time. So that's where they're at right now. Things change so quickly in the NFL, and I think the thing that you have to be optimistic about, if you're a Packer fan, Rodgers does seem to be healthy. Eddie Lacy will be back soon. James Starks didn't play well in this game, which is kind of a surprise because the Lions' run defense really hasn't been that good this year. I think the encouraging thing is that offensively, the skill position players look healthy. Randall Cobb also looks pretty healthy. Not very productive right now, so maybe the injury is bothering him more than he's physically kind of showing us. Like, maybe there's some issues getting off the line, getting separation.
He had a couple big drops in this one, too. There was one along the sideline, wide open. I think it was in the first half at some point that he probably catches and goes for a touchdown if it doesn't let it go off his hands. So even these guys are healthy, they're not performing, though. I don't know if that's really that encouraging to me.
Well, I think what we're going to see throughout these games as we recap them, teams have ups and downs throughout the year. And if you're coming off of two difficult road matchups. Broncos and Panthers on the road are tough road assignments. They are. I mean, going into Denver, playing at altitude, playing against that defense is difficult. Carolina's defense has been good for the last couple of seasons and is really kind of borderline elite right now. It's a top three, maybe top five defense if you really don't like them that much. I think that's where they belong. So losing there is not so bad. Losing at home to the Lions is bad. So maybe this is their awful loss, their worst loss of the year. But you think back,
it doesn't get much. You can't. I mean, they're not going to play a worse team than Detroit this year.
Yeah, especially getting them at home too. Like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, losing at home to Detroit is probably going to be their worst loss of the season. But look at the loss that Arizona had, a bad loss to Pittsburgh earlier this year, right? Like, there
they
are other
St. Louis as well.
Yeah, they had a home loss to St. Louis. I mean, there are some teams that are good teams that have ugly losses. Minnesota in week one got just demoralized by San Francisco on Monday Night Football. And I know it was the late game. It was the first game of the year. There's a lot of factors that could be in play there. But if you look at every single team over the course of the year, they will have usually a bad loss at some point. Maybe one of those teams, the Patriots don't seem to do that. That's just one of their signatures, I guess, is that they typically, it takes a really good or almost perfect game to beat them. Like, ask the Giants about that. The Giants played pretty well yesterday and still couldn't get the job done. So I look at this and I see a good team that has still some room for improvement. It looks like everything's out of sync offensively. And everyone's kind of selling on Aaron Rodgers right now. He's 17th in YPA, I think, as of right now. It was in the Stopa column this morning on the site. And it's like, this is great. I actually like this. I like the opportunity for a team as talented as the Packers to step back, figure a few things out, and to get the momentum going in mid-December into the playoffs, as opposed to rolling through the first 10, 11 games and then struggling in December, which was the case a little bit last year, and it's been the case for them before. I mean, think about the year they lost to Kansas City, right? Like, in the late regular season, they were trying to go undefeated. They lost there, stumbled into the playoffs, got bounced early. Like, that's the kind of thing that can happen when you're not playing your best at the end of the season. So I'm not quite panicking yet. I don't think I would panic because I don't have that. I just have that confidence in Rodgers that he can get it right.
Will you be panicking if they lose to Minnesota next week?
No, I mean, I think Minnesota's a good team. So I think most other people here are going, it depends how they lose. If they lose because the offensive line's getting blown up and the offense is just dropping balls and Rodgers is missing, if they basically do what they did against Detroit again in Minnesota, Yeah, then you're kind of worried because you're not seeing any sort of progress.
Good teams don't lose four games in a row. Most good teams don't lose three games in a row. I mean, you made the comparison to Arizona. They had that bad loss in week three to St. Louis. They respond beating Detroit 42-17 the next week. After that, they lose to the Steelers, another bad loss. That was in Pittsburgh, just kind of an odd game. That offense seemed out of sync. They come back now, and they've won three straight. So I think the mark of a good team is that they don't let these losses compound, and that's exactly what Green Bay has been able to do right now. And I'm still not panicking, like you said, but it's just – it's very, very alarming to see an Aaron Rodgers team look this bad offensively.
There's also something about them that, okay, on the flip side of like things I am actually a little worried about, is that for a few weeks we've seen them make the same kinds of mistakes. And I wonder, I guess a lot of the comments after the game and all that.
Sports Talk Radio last night was unbelievable.
Oh, I'm sure they were just burying everyone because, you know, Rodgers isn't saying much about what's wrong. No one's really talking much. Like, no one's really saying anything.
I think that's good. I think that's for the best. I don't know what talking really does much for you in this situation. I think people want to see the accountability maybe a little bit more, but at the end of the day, it's just talk.
What do the people want? Like, people who want someone, like my dad, I was talking to my dad at the game. He said, well, someone's got to say something. It's like, why? What do you want said? What are you going to feel better about? They just experienced the game that we all watched. They know what happened.
Right.
You know, so Roger's saying, well, we're going to watch the tape. That's what they're going to do. He's just telling you what they're going to do next to get better, and they're going to figure out what's wrong, and they're going to try to fix it. That's how the game works. If he comes out and trashes Randall Cobb for dropping a ball that he knows Randall Cobb's going to catch 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, what does that do? That doesn't do anything.
Yeah, well, and part of the, you know, some of the criticism of Rodgers this season and in the past has been, you know, his on-field body language, his kind of... he can be a little bit abrasive. You know, I think early in the year, it was Ty Montgomery in like week 2 or 3 dropped a pass, and Rodgers kind of talked about it. You know, he didn't bring it up himself, but he was asked about the play and, you know, just didn't issue the nicest response, I guess. You know, and oftentimes when there's a drop, he's, you know, he's yelling at the coach on the sideline. He's oftentimes it's probably directed at himself. But I think people seem to think that he can be a little bit of, I don't know what the right word is exactly. Just kind of a diva, I guess, for lack of a better term. That's something you see quite a bit on Twitter these days, especially after the game. And like you said, I don't know what him expounding on, you know, on what the issues are or talking more to the press, I don't know what that solves for this team.
No, it really doesn't solve much of anything. Now, the defense played, I thought, pretty well. I mean, the Amir Abdullah kick return was a big difference maker. The drive late in the game that put the Lions up, I think was it 18-8 at the time? No, it was 18-10, I think. That looked like they were going to kick the extra point and just win 19-10, yep. And then Prater missed the extra point. That drive was a pretty impressive drive, and I think a big part of the reason why they had to punt before that was that Devontae Adams penalty.
Yep.
The things that I'm bothered by, the coaching is horrible. Like, Mike McCarthy is a bad game manager. He might be a good offensive mind. He might be good at scheming. He might be good at designing formations and making plays. Might be great at that. I don't know. It's hard to grade a coach who's playing with a Hall of Fame quarterback. I mean, it really is, because we haven't seen this level of success from him for 15 years. It's not a Belichick-like level of success where you're like, okay, he's a big part of the reason why, because they get other things personnel-wise right, and everything seems really organized and meticulous. With McCarthy, you have issues like the failure to use timeouts before the two-minute warning. You know, if the Packers burn their timeouts before the two-minute warning, the Lions score earlier. There's more time left on the clock, and this game doesn't end quite as easily. There's more time for that last drive, which Packers didn't end up needing it, but you don't make that mistake because sometimes that will cost you. It's just he does things like that. He doesn't seem like he has complete control of his locker room. It's an outside observation because we're not on the beat. We're not covering the team every day.
Full disclosure.
Just in case you thought we were there, we're not. But it's just one of those things where you watch and you're like, well, who are the leaders on this team other than Rodgers? Is Clay Matthews really a big leader? Like, who knows? Like, it's hard to tell. I see where the criticism comes from, but I just wonder how much the players on that team actually respect him as their coach. Like, I think it actually wavers quite a bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the play calling duties. Obviously, McCarthy gave those up. I don't think there's been a lot of clamoring for him to take those back.
There's
now
no discernible difference right now.
Well, you right, that's the thing.
Nothing has changed.
And people hated that McCarthy was calling the plays and wanted them stripped after the playoff loss to Seattle. And now, you know, nothing's really changed, and now they want him to take it back. I don't know if that's really the solution, but you know, you talked about the overreactions on Twitter and on Facebook. My dad, of course, took to Facebook to air his concerns, as most people do. But a few samples from comments left on the Gamer in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel recap. Watch Aaron Rodgers pregame. He was smiling, laughing, and joking with other players. Didn't strike me as an attitude he should be having. Aaron Rodgers needed to choose Munn or the Packers.
Really?
Rodgers put up a terrible performance for the third week in a row, and he's worried about a drunk fan in the crowd? What a baby. Any chance Favre suits up for Thanksgiving night? I still hate Favre for the way he ended it with the Packers, but wouldn't blame Rodgers for wanting to bail as well. Ted Thompson must be cleaning out his office right now, I guess. Bench Aaron Rodgers and let Scott Tolzien finish the season so Rodgers isn't seriously hurt. Where's the pay taker? Getting ready for Pitch Perfect 3?
Oh.
And this could go on and on. I'm reading, these are just like the top six, and there are probably about 30 more of that variety. So Packers Nation, not in a great spot right now. The pay taker, I think that's a new one. I've heard the rest of those, but the pay taker.
Please help. Okay, everybody listening, look, all 20 of you, please help us. I tweet at us. You can just tweet at RotoWire if you want. You can tweet at Waylon. The L is a number one.
Yes, it
is. Or at Derek Van Riper. Are Packer fans actually just like St. Louis Cardinal fans, and I just don't realize it? Are
yes.
we them?
Because I had this argument with somebody earlier in the summer during baseball season. I think it might have been KOB out in the office saying, you know, he said something like, man, there's nothing like Cardinals fans. And I was like, honestly, as somebody who's not really a diehard Packers fan, I was like, I think people nationally probably think Packers fans are like Cardinals fans.
I think right now they're the closest thing to it because historically speaking, they're franchises that have had equal amounts of success. They're
right.
fan bases that are very passionate, even though I hate the St. Louis Cardinals in like normal sporting
they're more,
ways.
They're more like viciously loyal than they are. I mean, they are very passionate as well.
But I think
more of a,
I think Packer fans have that vicious loyalty in them too. Like,
yeah,
I think Packer fans are as willing as any to look past the transgressions of their players and defend their players when they're doing wrong. I mean,
well, like, to be fair, they don't seem to have too many of those type of issues. I mean,
they don't have the extreme outliers. They don't have the Hardys and the APs, but they'll have guys that get arrested for domestic violence and
Nick Barnett.
It'll be under the radar kind of stuff. Yeah, like it'll just kind of be brushed over because it's a role player and fans kind of just look past that. And I think that's not unique to Packer fans, but I'm just saying. That could be the difference. The Cardinal fans are extremely aggressive about it. Packer fans have what seems like a more friendly disposition. But again, I'm here. I'm biased. I'm curious.
Well, even,
that's why I'm asking about it. I want to know, like, what do other people think? What do non-Packer fans
right.
think of Packer
We don't
fans?
Really get that sample here, you know, being in Madison. And you know, this is still two
right.
hours away from Green Bay. But, you know, the other thing is Packer fans are pretty quick. I think we saw that yesterday to turn when things go south. And again, this isn't something that's unique to Packer fans. Every fan gets frustrated when their team loses three in a row and is down to Detroit at home. But I mean, we saw the Boo Birds were out like mid first quarter
yeah,
in this game.
And well,
and booed off the field at Lambeau Field. The Green Bay Packers got booed off the field.
Your feedback that you threw in there from people like, you know, hoping Favre suits up on Thanksgiving and things like that. Most people would say that like tongue in cheek.
Right.
Some people
and
around here will say that seriously. Like they even my wife was talking to me. She goes, you know, I always just felt like Favre was more in control of those situations. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, Rodgers has come back and won games like that before, too. Like, if anything, Rodgers is more methodical in his play in a way where you'd feel a lot more calm watching him than you would watching Favre. Like, I just think people forget what it was actually like.
There were tweets during the game, people saying, cut Jared Aberderis, go sign T.O.
What?
T.O.?
What's T.O. even doing right now?
I have no idea. He's doing sit-ups in his driveway, probably. I don't know. This is enough probably lamenting the Packers. I think this becomes the biggest game of the year for them now against Minnesota. Very quickly, a game that has a lot more meaning than people probably ever thought it would at this point. 9 straight possessions after that opening field goal with a punt, though, for this Green Bay offense. And I think that's the biggest thing that stands out to me. And the defense has its issues, but they played well enough. I think you allow 18 points the Lions at home. I think you'll take that most of the time, assuming your offense can get at least 19 points. And you know, obviously that wasn't the case on Sunday, but you know, a lot to look forward to now with Minnesota. And like you said, Chicago and Detroit up next. So 3 straight division games are going to have huge implications for 2 of those teams. Jaguars 22, Ravens 20. And you know, it was conflicting for me as a Jaguars fan who also has a rooting interest in the Packers. Big day for Duval Nation. The Jags Certainly, we're jagging off quite a bit in this one. A last-second field goal from Jason Myers after he shanked a 26-yarder that would have proven to be the go-ahead game-winning field goal earlier in that second half. Gets set up for a 53-yarder. Jags are officially on the prowl, one game out in the AFC South. Indy, of course, is off this week. If Houston loses tonight, they'll officially be tied with the Texans, one game back of Indianapolis. Very weird ending to this game. Baltimore's up 20-19. They have a 4th-and-5 from the Jacksonville 45, and they opt to punt. This is pretty late in the game, about a minute left or so. Jags take over at their 20. Bortles marches them down to about midfield. I think they got to the Baltimore 49. They had a 4th-and-4, it would have been like a 3rd-and-10 with like 8 seconds left. And Bortles, you know, in this situation, you need to get to the sideline, no timeouts. Throws it short over the middle to Julius Thomas. Great call.
Smart.
And Thomas goes down with like 6 seconds on the clock. And to the Jags' credit, they got up to the line and got a playoff like right as time expired. Like watching it live, I thought they didn't get it off. It was very close. And I don't think the Baltimore defense thought they got it off either. If you watch the play, like the defensive line for Baltimore is just kind of standing up. I think everybody wasn't sure if they got the playoff or whatever the deal was. Elvis Dumervil, the defensive end for Baltimore, is really the only guy who seemed to be going hard. He gets around right edge. Bortles takes the snap on 4th-and-4, immediately trips over his own feet and falls down, gets back up. Dumervil hits him, but grabs him by the face mask. I don't know if you saw the Manziel face mask yesterday. It was pretty similar to that. Maybe not quite as violent, but, you know, grab twisted around his neck, a very clear 15-yard face mask. So that happens as time expires. Jags get an untimed down from the Baltimore 34, which allowed Myers to kick that 53-yarder. And he also fell down after kicking it. So just a lot of falling in general for the Jags, but made it. And the Jags now move to 3-6.
Yeah, one game out of first place. One game out of first place, right?
So they're going Matt Hasselbeck taking over for Indianapolis.
I think the Jags are actually in the driver's seat, and they just don't know it yet.
They actually might be, and that's what's pretty sad about this. I heard Indianapolis was trying to the word that I think Adam Schefter used last week was lure Jason Campbell out of retirement. I don't know. The image that creates for me is they're calling up Jason Campbell like, hey, man, you should stop over at the stadium for something. Like, what do you guys want? Oh, no, nothing. You know, maybe just bring your pads, bring your jersey. I don't know if they're going to look out and try to grab a veteran or if it's going to be Matt Hasselbeck, who's actually 2-0 as a starter for this Colts team. But the AFC South is a complete mess, but a very interesting mess at the same time.
What about Josh Freeman? What's he up to these days?
Oh, he's playing somewhere. I just read something about him.
Canada?
That might be it. I don't know. I don't know what his deal is, but
It's strange he washed out of the league.
He's playing for the Brooklyn Bolts of the Fall Experimental Football League, or the FXFL.
So what do you think is experimental about that league?
Isn't it weird to put that in the title? Like, even if the league is just starting and it's experimenting, like, why would you put experimenting?
I would make that a parenthetical mention.
Like, at some point, you're
going
to have
somewhere.
To, like, say this league actually takes off. Like, in 10 years, you can't have it be the experimental league anymore, right?
Probably not, but for nostalgic reasons, you may have to keep that name forever. So that's just it's a risk.
A lot of nostalgia behind that.
Willing
game.
To take, I guess. I mean, he's only 27. He's a former first-round pick. Right. I think there were some issues off-field, some reasonable ones that other players have had, and he just got cast away as just like this guy that can't be an NFL quarterback. He threw for 4,000 yards in 2012, 27 TDs,
he wasn't bad.
17 picks. You're telling me he's not good enough to be on one of the rosters, at least as a backup? That's kind of crazy.
Right. You would think, Tim Tebow's out there if we want to go down that rabbit hole. But
of course we do.
No, we definitely don't. But looking back at this Jags game, Bortles, 22 of 45, 188 yards, not the best game from him. Did salvage it with 2 touchdowns, had a pick early in the first half. Allen Hurns, 5 catches, 62 yards, and a touchdown. That's 7 straight games now with a touchdown for Allen Hurns. First player since Dez Bryant in 2012 to do that. The all-time streak for most consecutive games with a touchdown catch, not surprisingly, Jerry Rice, but that was over a span of 2 seasons. Randy Moss and the great Carl Pickens both had 10-game streaks. The single-season leader, if you're curious, Derek, A.J. Green and Lance Altworth. I do not know who Lance Altworth is. I'm assuming this is an older player. But both of those guys had 9-game single-season streaks. So Hurns is coming for him.
I think that might have been Lance Altworth. But
is that what I said?
No, just not Altworth.
Oh, Altworth.
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 Yeah. But still, he probably, yeah, you never heard of him. Carl Pickens, though, brings back memories to my early days of playing fantasy football. He's one of
the first players that I remember. Him and Peter Warwick running around out there for the Bengals.
Pickens would just, like, run fly patterns, and Jeff Blake would somehow throw it over everyone's head, and it would work. I don't know.
Is Jeff Blake still around, speaking of possible backup quarterbacks? Like, I would not be shocked at all if he turned up on a roster.
Jeff Blake is 44, so I think he's still within the Warren Moon age range of playing. His career actually ended in 2005, so after 10-plus years of retirement. Yeah. There's a video that comes up when you Google Jeff Blake, and it's entitled Jeff Blake, the best deep ball thrower in the history of the, and I assume it's going to say NFL if I click through on it, which
could
I'll click
Cincinnati
through on
Bengals.
It later. Could be. Could just be Bengals. I think maybe. Yeah, no, it's history of the NFL.
Well,
so
that's a fact if it's on YouTube.
Video posted by D&H Sports, so yep. You really can't argue with that.
Nope. Well, going back to Hearns, Michael Floyd, if you're curious, has the second longest current active streak with 4 games. So I think, you know, playing in Jacksonville and for what's a pretty bad 3-win team gets overshadowed, but a pretty remarkable year, honestly, for Allen Hearns, a guy who's probably going to end up being a Pro Bowler, going to end up with very nice numbers when it's all said and done. Allen Robinson, another receiver who's playing very, very well for Jacksonville, he had a touchdown as well, 5 catches, 51 yards for him. I think he's the first player that I, like, genuinely have really liked on this team in, like, close to 10 years.
So are you going to wait until the Jags pivot off of the Arena League uniforms before you buy an Allen Robinson jersey?
I'm really coming around on these uniforms. I hate the helmet, the two-tone. You know, it's supposed to, the helmet allegedly is supposed to look like it fades from, like, matte black to gold, but, like, there's a pretty clear line where it's just black and gold. And, like, if it actually did fade and, you know, look maybe more like something Oregon would wear, that would probably be cool, but it's a very poorly executed helmet at this point. But I do like the jersey pants combination. I think if they just went back to the old style helmets, they would look pretty good. Don't like the gold uniforms that they're going to be rolling out this Thursday. And gold is kind of a relative term, I guess, when talking about these things. They're more like honey mustard color.
Honey mustard is delicious, though.
I don't think so.
Why don't you like honey mustard? Do you like chicken patties? You don't like honey mustard?
Nah, I don't really like mustard. It's got a pretty mustardy taste, which is not a good association for me. Coming out with the hot takes. Mustard tastes like mustard.
Mustard tastes like mustard.
No, I don't think I've ever had honey before either, so I just don't really want to mess with that at all.
How many things have you eaten and can you make on one 8x11 piece of paper, could you write down all the different foods you've ever consumed? Would it all fit on one side?
I think I could have up until I was like 18 before I come into college. I was a very, very picky eater, and, you know, fortunately for me, my mom catered to that. My sister is kind of the same way, so we didn't really branch out much as far as exotic foods, but, you know, I've definitely expanded my palate a little bit coming to Madison, a city with a lot of great restaurants. But yeah, I mean, like, I hadn't tried, like, mayonnaise until a couple years ago, like I said, like, things like that, you know, still haven't had honey before. It's just not really something that's on my bucket list at all.
Honey's good. Mayonnaise, whatever. I mean,
or leave it. Like, ranch was the same way. I was always kind of scared to try ranch, but then, like, that's been a game changer for a lot of ways.
Right. Know? Yeah. Ranch also goes on chicken patties.
Right.
And,
I mean,
buffalo, chicken stuff, anything. I'm surprised you've never had honey, but honey mustard, I think, would
When would I actually need honey, though? Like, what? That is, like, something that I know most people have tried, but, like, when would I ever just be like, I'm going to have some honey? Like, what would I even eat that with?
I don't know. Winnie the Pooh just eats it out of the jar. So, I mean, put it on...
I'm not an animated bear, Derek.
Bread or something? Breaking, Nick's not an animated bear. I always thought he was, but he's not.
I typically wear pants. I don't wear just, like, one single red shirt that doesn't cover my midriff.
It is kind of weird that a lot of the animated characters don't wear pants. Like a lot of the ducks from, was it DuckTales or whatever? Like Scrooge McDuck doesn't wear pants either, I don't think.
No, I don't think he does.
Elvin and the Chipmunks, I don't think they wear pants.
It's just such a bad example, and that's kind of what it comes down to.
That's probably why kids never want to wear pants. Like little kids hate wearing pants.
Elvin and the Chipmunks don't wear pants, yeah.
I blame the cartoons.
Yeah, I think that's certainly fair. Closing thoughts on this Jags game, TJ Yeldon. Decent game for him. They kind of went away from him in the second half. 18 carries, 61 yards. Justin Forsett, 15 carries, 53 yards. Not much there. Joe Flacco, nice game for him at a loss. 34 of 45, 316 yards, 3 touchdowns, but did have 2 picks. Cowboys, 6. Buccaneers, 10. I thankfully did not get to catch much of this game. This was kind of lost in the wash, I guess, in this early slate of games. And I don't think we really missed much, Derek. No touchdowns in this game until the last minute. Maybe just over a minute when Jameis Winston went in on a naked bootleg, got a second chance. I don't know if you saw the play where he flipped into the end zone. I think it was on a third down, fumbled the ball before he was even hit. I mean, the flip was pretty violent. I mean, he almost did a complete front flip and cleared about 5 yards. It was relatively impressive. Dropped the ball, but the play was called back due to defensive holding. Not something you often see on a QB run play. And then on that next play, Jameis was able to punch it in on that bootleg from the one. Dallas gets the ball back. Matt Castle picked off on what was probably a 50 to 60-yard throw. Just a complete bomb. Kind of a Hail Mary in a lot of ways to Dez Bryant. A lot of people were saying Bryant gave up on the ball. I don't know if you saw the highlight of this one yet. He definitely did. I mean, he started calling for a penalty, it seemed like, in midair. But at the same time, the ball was thrown over the opposite shoulder that he was expecting it. I don't know that he could have really made a play. It wasn't really as blatant as people were making it sound.
No, he got shoved a little bit, too, right, by the DB. I mean,
I don't know what. I mean, there was no way he was going to make the catch. Like, at best, he maybe disrupts an interception. I don't think this is on Dez.
I mean, some people just don't like Dez, so they're going to criticize everything he does fairly or unfairly, and this seems to be pretty unfair, but this was a Hail Mary for sure. It wasn't like a real, like,
it was double coverage, yeah. I mean, and if there's any receiver in the league who can come up with that play, maybe it is Dez, but yeah, it was a tough throw and not really well placed by Matt Castle.
This game was trash, though. I mean, like, I barely saw it. I had the red zone going on one TV, and
they were never in the red zone, really.
In the great tire fire of Green Bay on the bigger TV, and it was just like Mike Evans did Mike Evans things. Doug Martin didn't have a very good game in a good spot. Darren McFadden was in my DraftKings lineup, so that's why he sucked. Darren McFadden's only reason for existing is to destroy my fantasy teams,
and he said that publicly, hasn't he?
Yes, he came out after the game. He said, DVR's an idiot. And he walked away. That's all he did. I mean, this was supposed to be a great spot for him. This should have been 100 yards, a TD, pretty easily. And he had, 58 yards from scrimmage? I mean, he's still 17 carries to Christian Michael's 3, so that's good. That doesn't help me. I don't have him in season-long leagues where I care about him. So, I said I was done with him 3 years ago. Now I'm done with him in daily, too.
Yeah, I mean, 21 rushes for 42 yards for this Dallas team. They were just 4 of 13 on third down, so only 11 first downs. Just not a game to remember for this Dallas offense. Jameis Winston looked all right, though. 22 of 39, 264 yards. Did have 2 picks, but first turnover since week 4, and that's really been the big thing for him, and especially, you know, rookie quarterbacks overall. Now he has a rush touchdown in his last 3 games. Seems to be a little more confident running the ball, especially around the goal line. Is he giving Marcus Mariota kind of a run for his money in that Rookie of the Year race?
Probably. I mean, I think it's going to be pretty close because Tampa's had a little more success than Tennessee to this point, and I think that's going to carry some weight.
Mariota's missed some games.
And not turning the ball over is a good thing. And the 2 picks, obviously, were a small setback. And overall, and that's as much as the Bucs can ask him to do so, like, to this point. I mean, he's got Mike Evans and little else right now. Austin Seferian-Jenkins is banged up, and Vincent Jackson's banged up, so we really haven't seen a second receiver step up for him. And I think once that happens, we might see that production kick up even further.
Right. And, you know, we're forgetting Todd Gurley is probably going to be the front runner for that award.
Gurley's
going to
win the award. He should. It's over.
Carolina 27, Tennessee 10. I was very glad to see Tennessee get back on the losing side of things. Obviously, there's some Jags implications there as well.
The Titans are 2 back right now of the Colts for the AFC South.
It's pretty sad. And, yeah, I mean, honestly, that Thursday night game this week against Jacksonville is going to be huge, and it's just sad that that's a realistic thing. But, yeah, I mean, I'd still get my Tennessee under 6 wins bet looking pretty good right now. I don't really like them as a second-half team here. But where did you stand, the big takeaway from this game, and what was a pretty – you know, I think it was what we expected. Carolina came in, took care of business, nothing flashy. Good game from Cam Newton. What was your take on that celebration in the fourth quarter that seemed to draw the ire of Twitter?
Why did it draw the ire of Twitter? What did it really...
Well, this is like the peak Cam being Cam, right? I mean, this is what everybody hates on Cam Newton for, and then he just took it to, like, the biggest level that we've seen.
I mean, like, what... I don't know. I'm watching it right now to see, like, if there's anything unusual about it.
I think he should have been flagged. First of all, I'm in 100% favor of players doing stuff like this, even if it gets them a flag. I think it's great. I think if you're undefeated and you're playing like Cam Newton is, you can do whatever you want. I loved his quote after the game, basically saying, if you don't want me to dance, keep me out of the end zone. But I still think that celebration went on for close to 30 seconds. I mean, that's got to be flagged, I think. And, you know, at that point, it probably wouldn't have mattered for Carolina anyway, but I don't know. And the guy, what's the name of the Tennessee linebacker, 54, who came after him? I'm not sure who it was. But this is the same guy who was doing the Drake hotline bling dance earlier in the game after a sack.
If you can call Drake's hotline bling dance an actual dance, then yeah, he was doing
alleged
that.
Dance.
Alleged dance.
Purportedly.
I have no problem with this. And I think the best – where I think he was in danger of being flagged is when he was approached by the defensive player doing it again. Like that might have been –
doing it two more times and then running and grabbing the ball and giving it to a fan as he always does.
Yeah, well, I have no problems with
this. Well, the funny thing is, to be seeing the video is like, you know, this is an NFL linebacker coming at him, and Cam's got what, like 5 inches?
Cam is huge,
and like 80 pounds.
If you're a linebacker, do you really want to go like pick a fight with Cam?
That's the funny thing about it. It's like, yeah, like the one quarterback or maybe like one player, offensive player in the league that you don't want to pick a fight with is Cam Newton. And I loved Cam's reaction. You know, I mean, he initially backed up just enough to know that he wasn't going to get flagged and then just kept doing it. Why not?
So, hey, here's my question for you with the Panthers. I mean, still undefeated, a team that's exceeded expectations this year.
Yeah.
And yet, Cam is such a huge part of their offense. Why do they expose him at the goal line like that? Like, isn't that a critical mistake? In hindsight, when you have other ways to score, you can hand it to Stewart, you can hand it to the bookshelf, you could roll him out at least, not have him like run directly into guys, maybe avoid some contact. Like it just seems like there's a lot of other ways you could score here. And if Carolina's season in like week 15, let's just say they're 13-1 in week 15 or 12-2, and they're in the drive, they're doing a good job, they're winning the NFC South, he's still playing. It takes some blow to the head near the goal line on a play like that because it's reasonably just reaching the ball out. Someone just blasts him in the helmet, takes the penalty, and he misses a few games because of it, misses a playoff game because of it. Like, there's going to be a lot of heat on Ron Rivera for that. And it's just like, I understand, like, you have a weapon that such that you want to use him from time to time. You want that to be a threat. You want that to be part of what you're doing in close. I just wonder if they go to it more than they should. Like, at what point does Cam Newton go down the road of other mobile quarterbacks who have been around long enough to actually, you know, not have their head just hanging around but the goal line to where defenders could, I don't know, hit it if they want to?
Yeah, that is a fair point. You know, why not just hand it off to the human dump truck?
Because they run it well enough where they could do that. And again,
right, especially at the one-yard line, like this play that we were just describing. I don't know. The formation that they used was interesting. They pretty much stacked, I think it was Newton under center, or was he out of the gun? I'm not sure.
He was out of the gun on this play.
Like, they had what, like, how many guys on the end of that line to the right? I mean, it was basically a QB power, right, off tackle. But they had, you know, they had your base two offensive linemen to the right of the center, and then at least two or three more guys stacked on that side. And it was basically just a kind of a stretch play, I guess, more than anything, where Newton just kind of cautiously walked, like jogged right until finding a hole and just kind of blast his way into the end zone. And that's kind of how they use him. And I think that worries me less than a guy, you know, Michael Vick is always the guy you point to when you're talking about mobile quarterbacks, a guy who is, you know, running around in the open field and, you know, getting hit like that. You risk more, you know, a guy rolling up on you in that situation. Cam's always moving at like such a low speed that I'm not quite so worried with him because he's a guy that you're not worried about taking contact because he is so big and he's kind of able to withstand those hits more than most mobile quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, the size factor is something there. It's just one of those things that stands out to me as really risky for the Panthers given how important he is to them, that you'd expose him. In certain situations, you'd be more willing to do it than others. That was with a 20... They're already up 20-10.
Yeah,
there, right?
That's an interesting point. Is at that point in the game, maybe not. I think if it's a critical down and, you know, maybe the score is tied or you're down or something like that, then, you know, no holds bar. You got to run Cam. But yeah, in that situation against a bad team in a game that you basically have locked up, it's certainly an interesting decision. And I don't think we mean to accuse Ron Rivera of trying to, you know, pump up Cam's MVP case or anything like that.
No,
right?
No, it's nothing like that. It's just one of these things that, again, eventually it's going to be something that you look at and go, okay, should we really be exposing him to this? Maybe not as often as we do.
Right. But, I mean, it's working. What is this now, 14 out of 15 games for Carolina, or 13 out of 14?
I like how some people talk about him as, like, having the longest unbeaten streaks. Like, they didn't win the Super Bowl. They got bounced. Like, that
still though,
it's impressive. They're playing very well for a team that 2 years ago we were talking about Ron Rivera as a joke of a coach who probably shouldn't be a head coach anymore, and now he's probably on his way to coach of the year
right now.
Yeah for sure.
You know, I think we talked a little bit about this last week. I mean, Marvin Lewis is obviously going to be in that conversation. Mike Zimmer, I think, as well. But still a long way to go there. Quick notes for the Titans. Not much to talk about on their end. Mariota, pretty quiet, 16 of 24, 185 yards and a pick. Jonathan Stewart for Carolina, 91 yards, excuse me, on 22 carries and a touchdown for him. Dexter McCluster continuing to salvage points for me in the RotoWire League as I'm starting him alongside TJ Yeldon. 27 reception yards, led the Titans with 25 rushing yards, sadly enough. Did get in the end zone early in this game as well. The Titans really don't have a run game whatsoever. Their last 100-yard rusher was Chris Johnson in December of 2013.
yikes. I mean, how many people are just burned by Antonio Andrews coming off a good game last week? Would he have 10 yards or something? I mean,
something like that. Well,
awful.
I don't think they have an identity offensively right now at all, and that's certainly a problem. Bears 37, Rams, speaking of teams that don't have identities, 13. Look at this high-powered Chicago offense coming into St. Louis and that great defensive line and just taking care of business. Bears quietly sitting at 4-5 now. It looked like they were a team that, you know, people were talking, is this going to be a 2 or 3 win season after those first few weeks with the injuries they had? They're starting to sell off some starters, and now all of a sudden they look at least fairly passable as an NFL team.
Revenge game for John Fox and Adam Gase coming up, too.
Yeah.
So you can't count them out against the Broncos, as the Broncos might have to use Brock Osweiler at quarterback in that. Jay Cutler played really well, benefited from a few long TDs that were yards after the catch variety, not necessarily Cutler airing it out. But Jeremy Langford, 182 yards from scrimmage, 2 TDs. Zach Miller scored twice at 107 yards. I think one of those came on like an 86-yarder or something crazy. I mean, he actually just ran away from the pack after that play, too. It's kind of surprising to see him get that much separation. Elshon Jeffrey was quiet. Nick Foles sucked. Wes Welker played a little. Todd Gurley, if you paid up for him, didn't hurt you, but also didn't give you what you needed to account for the high price tag. Kadeem Carey somehow had 14 carries, even though Langford had 20. So he's the next in line, and I guess when the Bears have a huge lead, he'll get volume.
Yeah, maybe that's the most surprising fantasy result of this whole week, is like the Bears having 2 very productive running backs in one day.
Yeah, 34 carries for 2 backs, but I mean, Jeremy Langford looks good. If you're the Bears, I don't think you have any real reason to rush Matt Forte back, if only because you've got 2 guys that seem to be capable of handling the workload in his absence.
Redskins 47, Saints 14. The Saints continue to be a complete enigma from week to week. We know at this point the defense is terrible. The offense hasn't really proven yet one way or the other, but they fire Rob Ryan reportedly Monday morning. I think this move, you know, kind of was a long time coming. They were just waiting for this type of game to happen, and you know, Kirk Cousins took care of business pretty early in this one, finishing with a perfect passer rating of 158.3, of course, that magic number. 20 of 25, 324 yards, 4 touchdowns for him, no picks. They got the ground game going. Alfred Morris had 92 yards. Matt Jones had 56 yards. Chris Thompson had 54 yards, 38 of those coming on one carry. And then Matt Jones, 131 receiving yards on just 3 catches. Obviously, that was buoyed by that 78-yard screen pass. So a very productive day, surprisingly productive day for this Washington offense. And St. Louis just continue, or excuse me, New Orleans just continues to be a team that you can't trust on a week-to-week basis.
No, you really can't. Even Drew Brees had a pretty quiet day. Brandon Cooks seems like he's kind of come on strong here the last few weeks. 5 catches, 98 yards, 2 TDs. Other than that, it was a pretty dismal day for that New Orleans offense. Couldn't even really make use of garbage time in a game. They ended up losing by 33. I thought this would actually be a close game. I know the Saints are a pretty different team away from the Dome, but this was...
Even at this point, they seem to not be as invincible at home as they were over the last 5-6 years, too. I mean, they're a complete enigma from week to week.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of them ever. That sums it up perfectly. Really,
I keep a personal do not trust list for my Pick'em league just out of, you know, week to week fun, and they have been number one on that list for the last 3 weeks.
So, given that you never know what to make of them, do you just put a point or two, like a low number of confidence points on the team playing them every single week?
Well, actually, this week I rode New Orleans. I think I put 2 or 3 points on them. But yeah, I mean, they're basically, if you're on the top of the do not trust list, that means you put under 4 points on that game. And the Jaguars, I think, have been number 2 on that list for quite a while as well. So I just have a rule, you know, pick against the Jaguars at all costs. And, you know, it came back to bite me this week, but I think I'll be back on the winning side the rest of the year with that one. Miami 20. Philadelphia 19. Sam Bradford knocked out of this game midway through the third quarter. It looked like a sprained AC joint in his non-throwing shoulder. Still yet to see what the result is going to be of that. Also suffered a concussion. It sounds like they didn't realize he had the concussion until after they started evaluating him for the shoulder injury. But in came the Sanchez. Played all right. You know, not well enough to win this game, obviously, but 14 of 23, 156 yards. Did throw a pick. Didn't take any sacks, though, and Bradford was sacked 4 times for negative 39 yards, but you know, before leaving the game. Eagles' ground game continued to struggle, just 83 yards on 36 carries as a team. DeMarco Murray, 61 yards, 22 carries. Ryan Matthews didn't do much as far as yardage, but did get in the end zone. Ryan Tannehill basically played just well enough to win this game for Miami. 21 of 36, 217 yards, and a couple TDs for him. And I thought Jay Ajayi looked pretty good. The rookie out of Boise State who missed the first half of the season after being placed on IR, designated to return. He had 48 yards on six carries, including a 24-yard scamper in the first half.
Useful handcuff, I think, if Lamar Miller goes down. I think other than that, he's going to be someone that's pretty consistently limited volume-wise because Miller continues to play well, even though the yards per carry number was low in this matchup. The Eagles' front seven is pretty strong. They're pretty good against the run. Caught six balls for 50 yards, scored a TD. So I think Lamar Miller has really kind of firmed himself up as a top 10 running back. But Ajayi is one of those players that should be owned. And anywhere where he's floating on the waiver wire, he's a better handcuff than all but maybe three or four backs currently playing in backup roles.
Right, well, especially with the light workload, the relatively light workload that Lamar Miller has been getting throughout the season. What was the magic number that we had talked about? I think you were a Lamar Miller owner to start the year, and what, he just couldn't get past, like, was it 14 or 16 carries or something like that through the first 6 or 7 weeks?
It was a miserable experience, and I turned down the Miller for Tom Brady trade straight up in a 2QB league, which, yeah, was a mistake,
you know,
even with Miller playing well. But at least now, with Miller playing at the level that I was kind of hoping for when I bought him on draft day, it's a regrettable decision, but maybe not the most regrettable decision in my life.
All right, fantasy football just got a whole lot more interesting in Week 11. DraftKings will be hosting yet another Millionaire Maker event. This time, $1 million goes to first place, with a total of $5 million up for grabs. Go to DraftKings.com now, enter the promo code ROTOWIRE. That'll allow you to play free with your first deposit on DraftKings.com. Again, that promo code is ROTOWIRE for free entry now with your first deposit at DraftKings.com. This is not fantasy as usual. This is DraftKings. Welcome to the big time. Speaking of the big time, let's move to the AFC North. Pittsburgh 30, Cleveland Browns 9. Did get some Johnny Manziel action in this game. Josh McCown not playing. And this was probably far and away the best game of Manziel's NFL career, correct?
Yeah, I mean, 372 yards through the air, TD, a pick, actually led the Browns with 17 rushing yards. So that's a
big game on the ground.
Really encouraging for the Browns overall. Travis Benjamin got back on track in this one, 7 catches, 113 yards. He's been quiet for a few weeks. Manziel found Gary Barnage for a TD. Pretty much did everything you could want for a quarterback. They're only throwing the one pick in 45 attempts. Not sure if he did enough to necessarily keep Josh McCown from getting the job back after the bye when they were get back on week 12, but enough to make things even more confusing for Cleveland as they try to decide what to do with the position in the future.
Right. I don't know what Manziel has to do to take that position. You know, it seems like the Browns, you know, they're basically going to make him earn it through extremely good play on the field. And I don't know, like you said, 33 of 45 is nice, but just one touchdown. Obviously, they lose the game by three scores. I think it might take, you know, a more serious injury, I guess, more than anything else to McCown for Manziel to take over full time. But it's getting to the point for Cleveland that they know the direction this season is trending in. And we at this point know what Josh McCown's about. So, you know, from a fan perspective, I think I certainly want to see Manziel at least get a shot.
Oh, I want to see it just because I think for the Browns, he has more of a ceiling than Josh McCown does. McCown's played well this year, better than I thought. So
right.
Mike Pettine, maybe less of a dunce than I thought. But it doesn't mean I actually think he's smart. The crazy thing about this game is that Landry Jones started, hurt his foot early in the first quarter, and then Ben Roethlisberger played, which was not the plan at all. I think the Steelers were hoping to rest him. They have a Week 11 bye as well. If you started Martavis Bryant and or Antonio Brown on DraftKings, you got paid off in a big way. I mean, because the ownership rates should have been low. No one was expecting Landry Jones to go over 300 yards passing. Bryant had 6 catches, 178 yards, and a TD on 10 targets. Brown had 10 for 139, 2 TDs, 14 targets, big flip into the end zone.
That was crazy, right? I mean, he was running full speed.
Full speed.
Basically stopped on a dime and pulled a huge front flip and landed cleanly.
I love it from the entertainment standpoint. If I'm an Antonio Brown fantasy owner or if I'm the Steelers, I'm just like, come on, dude. Like, that was awesome, but don't ever do that again because we see non-contact ACL injuries all the time. If you're running full speed in football pads and throw a front flip,
there was like a defender far away. You could see him kind of check his rearview mirror quick before. I mean, there was a defender like 5-6 yards back. It wasn't exactly. It wasn't like he slowed up and had time to do this. It was like a split second decision. Like, hey, I'm gonna stop and flip here real quick.
Very impressive to say the least.
I can't do that.
No, I probably could on a trampoline.
What would happen if you tried to do that? Spinal injury, like paralysis?
No. See, like, here's the thing. I wouldn't injure my spinal cord because I have such a terrible lack of body awareness in the air. I'd probably belly flop. Like, I'd get up and, like, I'd, like, start to tuck, and I'd, like, swing my arms like I'm swimming through the air, and I would just face plant.
It's like an audible gasp from the crowd.
Right. Like, whoa. It looked like you were going to do something really awesome there, and then you just dove on your face.
Van Riper is down.
I'd get up and, like, brush off my shoulders. I mean, the one thing I've learned as someone who's kind of, like, inconsistently coordinated. Like, sometimes I'm kind of coordinated.
Just going hot streaks?
Yeah. Like, sometimes, like, I can ice skate and I'm pretty good. And then, like, other days, like, I'm going for a run and I, like, step through a puddle and there's some, like, soap or something in it and I just fall. And I'm down. Like,
I watch out for those soap puddles.
Yeah. I don't know what this substance was. I've been trying to figure out. I was going for a jog near where I live. And there's a park, and they had a sprinkler out. And you'd think, okay, this is just water just running down this hill onto the sidewalk. No big deal. I'm going to go right through it. I run through it, and my feet just slide out from underneath me. And I, like, barely catch myself from hitting my face on the concrete, which,
yeah, that's
as a man of many radio shows and podcasts, would have been devastating for my career. But I get up, and I've fallen enough random times where I kind of try to play it cool. And I saw there's a girl, like, walking her dog across the street. So I get up, and I just brush off my shoulder just as casually as possible, picking myself back up, and just start running. And I look down, like, 3 minutes later when I'm out of sight of this girl and her dog, so I don't look like a complete idiot.
Right.
I got blood running down my leg, and it's just like, really? Like, from just going for a run? And
It's risky out there. Running's not what it used to be.
No, it definitely isn't. So now I run through that area, and the same thing has happened on other days. They're watering, and it does have, like, it looks like someone washed a car at the park, and the soapy runoff is on the sidewalk, and it's slippery.
Kind of wondering what's in the city water in that part of town.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, like, the fertilizer or what it was, but it was, like, it was awful.
Did you watch the Gonzaga? This is kind of a tangent, but speaking of slipping, did you watch the Gonzaga-Pittsburgh game on Friday night?
Unfortunately, no.
They played this game at a gym at an Air Force base. I think it was Air Force. Might have been Marines. Some sort of military base in Japan. And I'm sure you're aware they used to do that aircraft carrier game to begin the year. And
yeah,
they basically ended that because of condensation. You know, you're playing on an aircraft carrier, which is floating on water and
moisture. Yeah,
right. There were some issues with that. Basically, the exact same thing happened in this game. It was so humid. And again, this is an enclosed gym, presumably with temperature control. And the court was so slippery that they had to call the game at halftime. And it was like, I'd watched part of the first half, and, like, they should have called it immediately. Like, guys were, like, coming up on fast breaks and, like, noticeably running differently, because if you ran full speed, you would just go down. Like, multiple players left. Like, this guy for Pittsburgh had his face just bleeding. Like, he slipped on just dribbling the ball up, fell flat on his face, and came back out with a Band-Aid. Like, it was just a complete mess. So I think I'm going to go out and publicly say I'm against playing games in jungle environments.
Jungle environments, aircraft carriers.
Let's just play them stateside.
Can we just play the games in the gyms they're meant to be played in?
I would like that.
Can we just do that?
And, like, Gonzaga was down. I mean, they're the number 9 team in the country. They were down to Pitt at halftime, and the game's not going to count.
Wow. That's dumb. That's just
dumb.
Stupid.
And if you're playing DFS, you got kind of screwed on that too.
Oh, you get zeros for that? Or did you get games?
I'm sure you get zeros.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the implications.
Or maybe they give you partial games either way. I mean,
you're getting half of what you paid for.
Half of the first game of the year of college basketball is not going to give you much.
No, that's not going to be good at all. One last thought on the Steelers and Browns. D'Angelo Williams, maybe the floor or the field was really slippery there too. Mm-hmm. 17 carries, 54 yards against the Cleveland defense. It's been pretty bad all year.
Yeah, that was disappointing. And I think we pumped up D'Angelo Williams about as much as anybody last week. Obviously one of the better backups in the league, but still, I mean, 54 yards on 17 carries could have been worse. Certainly not what you were expecting from him, but I think he gets back on track, especially with Ben Roethlisberger presumably going to be hampered the next couple weeks. Vikings 30, Raiders 14. Are the Vikings the sneakiest 7-2 team of all time?
Yes.
Yes, that's it. I think they are too. I think this is a game that I think I expected Oakland to win. First of all, and you know, they're coming off of a loss to Pittsburgh last week, but they looked really good in that loss. Everybody thought they had kind of turned the corner, but this Vikings team might be for real. Defensively, they're very, very good. Their running game is great. They don't really ask too much of Teddy Bridgewater, which I guess is a good thing, but at some point he's going to have to make plays for them, right, if they want to go from that, you know, take this to the next level and actually be taken seriously as a playoff contender.
Yeah, well, I mean, 1 week after getting knocked out on the field, he goes 14 of 22 for 140 yards and a TD.
That's a Tyrod Taylor line.
That's a Taylor line without the rushing yards.
Right,
so
that's the thing.
Not good. Who are the Raiders, though? I mean, losing by 16 at home. I thought these teams were actually pretty close to equal.
Derek Carr took a big step back this week.
Yeah, a couple picks. Amari Cooper, 5 for 79. Crabtree, 4 for 55. Both were disappointing. Carr had 302 yards, 2 TDs. One went to Clive Walford, who I used in the Stopa League for the second week in a row.
See, Wolf.
That is unbelievable. That's working out. Adrian Peterson is the key piece in the offense, as we expect him to be really all season. 26 carries, 203 yards, and a TD. Had a long of 80. I don't know the answer to this question. You threw this in the outline.
It's his
sixth career 200-yard game. Tied with, I'm going to say, O.J. Simpson for most all-time.
And you are correct.
I do.
Tied with O.J. Simpson for the most 200-yard games of all time. Peterson, though, has the record, as far as I could find on Pro Football Reference, for longest span between 200-yard games. He had a 200-yard game in 2007, and then he had one in 2015. So an eight-year span. Interestingly enough, O.J. Simpson had all six of his 200-yard games within a three-year span from 73 to 76. So I guess maybe that's 4 years if you're including the 76 season. So still, very impressive no matter how you slice it. He continues, obviously, to build his Hall of Fame career. But, yeah, Derek Carr, I was not impressed. You know, the two picks were big for this Oakland team, a team that was able to move the ball relatively well against a good defense, but both of those being obvious drive killers, kind of shooting themselves in the foot.
Vikings fans have to be feeling so good going into
next
that game against
the Packers.
Next week
is going to be very, very interesting.
You know they're going to go in really confident, especially with that game being in Minnesota.
Yeah, I'm anxious to see how that turns out. And this, like we said, I mean, this was a game that it was pretty evident, you know, maybe by week four, week five, that the Vikings were probably going to be the second best team in this division. But I don't think anybody expected them to come in at 7-2 and Green Bay to come in at 6-3. So, I mean, we talked about it from the Green Bay perspective. Obviously, this is not a must win for them, but good teams don't lose four games in the middle of the year and fall two back in the division against a Minnesota team that's proven capable that they're able to take care of business, you know, at least in games that they should win. And that's something that we really can't say about Green Bay right now. So statement game, I think, kind of in two different ways. For the Vikings, this is their game to say we're the team to beat in the NFC North. For the Packers, this is the, you know, the game where they say we need to turn things around.
Yeah, validation for the Vikings maybe, kind of proving
yes.
to everybody they belong.
That's the right
atop
word
the division
for.
And I think for the Packers it's more of just redemption and saying, hey, look, not so fast, little brother, we still own this division.
Exactly. Patriots 27, Giants 26. Tom Coughlin, clock management, not something that he is very good at right now. A couple puzzling decisions late in this game. Did you watch that final possession for the Giants?
So I had this game on while I was at dinner. I was at dinner at this place called Cafe Hollander. It's just pretty good. Pretty good beer, especially. A lot of good like foreign beers. So I had a obstructed view. This place seats 400 people, and I was in one of the 50 seats that doesn't have a great view of a TV. So I was a little disappointed by that. You know, luck of the draw, I guess, or whatever. I did not see this up close and personal. I saw fragments of this game, and it looked, at least from a Giants perspective, mostly like what you'd expect. You know, Eli going over 300 yards, getting pretty heavy volume, the running game sputtering. I saw the Odell Beckham TD early in the game. Didn't do much after that, really. He was pretty quiet for
the most part. We don't know what a catch is anymore, but almost had what would have been the game-sealing catch.
Saw that. Ball slapped out of his hands after it looked like he took two steps.
That was a catch to me. I don't know what a catch is anymore. And we saw, I mean, this has been a problem all season, but I think it was more of a problem in games across the NFL on Sunday. I mean, there were a couple in the Packers game alone, that being a noon game where it happened. And obviously the Odell Beckham one was huge. I don't know. I mean, it's almost different to me in the end zone scenario, because say you're running, you know, Beckham, let's say, catches it at the 10 and he runs in. As soon as the ball crosses the plane and it's in his possession, it's a touchdown, right? But if you're catching the ball, you have it in your possession, you get 2 feet in, at what point does it not, like, obviously the ball was knocked away, but, like, what does he have to do at that point? Like, I think Dan Le Batard was joking this morning that, like, does he have to go hand the ball to the ref and then it's officially a completed play? Like, there needs to be some sort of definitive action that rules something a catch or not a catch, and I think that's going to happen this offseason. I mean, it's gotten to the point where the NFL has to address this, right?
Complete the process. Just
what is the process?
The process?
We don't know what the process
don't
is.
Don't define the process. The other joke of an officiating scenario that took place, at least that caught my eye because I was watching this game in its entirety, was the Packers-Lions game. The Lions declined a penalty, saw that the Packers were going to go for it on fourth down, and then accepted a penalty, which...
That was basically Jim Caldwell. Like, whoa, 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 you guys are supposed to punt
here. Yeah, we think we would punt here. Why are you're going to go for it? Like,
oh, well, I guess...
But then, so Fox brought in Mike Pereira, and I thought, oh, this is actually like a really good time to bring in a referee. Like, and plus, it was Pereira, not Mike Carey. Like, when Mike Carey speaks, I get more confused about the NFL. I feel bad. Like, it's just, it gets worse.
Well, the thing is, Pereira's quote was like, yeah, the rule says, you know, his first response is supposed to be what you go with. But most refs just let you change it as much as they want.
Yeah, it's like, what do you mean you could change it? Like, once you decide,
That play didn't really upset me that much. You know, it could have happened either way. I'm sure it probably happens more often than we think across the NFL. But, yeah, that was an odd – because, I mean, there was a good, like, 30 seconds between –
there was a long, long break there.
Like, Green Bay was able to get on the field and line up as, like, right before they were about to snap the ball, before it seemed like they blew it dead and switched the acceptance on that.
Right, and like you said, this probably happens all the time. I just happened to notice it because there was a – longer break than usual, and it was a key spot in the game, and it's just one of those things where, you know, I expected Mike Pereira to say, well, the rule says this. It's like, well, it said that, but then they don't apply it, so it's like, come on. Yeah. Like, don't let anything ambiguous creep its way into the rule books. The more you allow them to decide, it's bad. Like, officials making decisions that are arbitrary on the fly is very, very bad. You don't want that.
Right, exactly. And I think the silver lining, if you will, is that it seems like that's a rule that's applied pretty consistently, as far as, you know, if a coach wants to change his mind, like, they're, you know, they don't favor certain calls over the other, certain coaches over another. Just, it seems like, you know, referees seem to understand, at least from Pereira's explanation, that that's kind of how it works. You know, you can technically, you can change your mind, but you're not supposed to. But I mean, it's one of those things that just, first of all, doesn't happen all that often. You know, it's not a situation – like, this is the first time that I've ever caught myself talking about it. But at that spot in the game, it certainly did make a difference.
Anyway, going back to the Patriots-Giants, Will Tye had a pretty big drop in the end zone that was actually Eli's fault. He threw a ball that – Tye was wide open. Eli just missed him by half a step, essentially. So the Giants had plenty of chances to put this one away, but they fall 27-26 to the Patriots. Gronk had a very Gronk sort of game, 5 for 113 and a TD. Danny Amendola picked up the slack after Julian Edelman left with a foot injury. Edelman expected to have foot surgery but could return this year. How do you see the Patriots distributing the targets? Does Amendola just plug right into the role that Edelman had? Or does LaFell pick up more? Does Gronk pick up more? Is it 80% Edelman goes to Amendola, the other 10% each goes to Gronk and LaFell?
I think more Amendola than anything else. I don't think this necessarily helps Gronk's value as much as maybe some might think. I don't think, like, Brady's looking for Gronk no matter what. You know, I don't know if it matters who the personnel are around him. I don't think this is going to change how teams cover Gronkowski. So it certainly doesn't hurt his value by any means. But I don't think this all of a sudden means he's going to start seeing five more targets per game. I think it's whoever runs those routes that Julian Edelman usually runs, and that's probably going to be Amendola. When we've seen, like, the Patriots are the most plug and play team, maybe other than the San Antonio Spurs in all of sports. It never really seems to matter. Obviously, Edelman has been a standout for them, and he's clearly the cream of the crop of what's been a pretty underwhelming receiving core, really, throughout the entire Brady era. If you throw out Randy Moss, they've just kind of been plugging and playing veteran guys like that, and I think Amendola steps into that role. I think his value is boosted more than a guy like Gronk or LaFell. But real quickly, going back to that Giants second-to-last drive. So they take over up two with 6 minutes left and put together, you know, one of the better drives for them of the year, a 15-play drive. They're killing time, doing exactly what they need to do, salt away the clock at New England, methodically get into New England field position. That was a terrible way of phrasing that. But first and goal on the New England 5 with 2:06 remaining. And they run three straight pass plays. Like, how? I mean, obviously you have the 2 minute warning there, and Belichick is as good at clock management as just about anybody. But I mean, you're at the 5 yard line. First of all, your chances of running the ball into the end zone are pretty good. Second of all, don't you want to kill as much time as possible? They end up punting it back to New England with 1:47 remaining.
Dumb, just dumb. I think you can justify throwing on the first play because you're going to run down to the 2 minute warning either way, and the clock stops.
And technically,
regardless,
they did score initially on the first play.
Yeah.
And it ended up being reversed. But I mean, at that time, it looked like the right call, I guess. But after that, I think you have 2:01 on the clock after the reversal. It's second down and goal. I think maybe you can pass it there because you have the 2 minute warning no matter what. But you have to at least try to run some time off and make New England take a timeout on that third down play.
Not a good look at all, though, for the Giants in this end game. They're 5-5 now on the season. And I still don't know what to make of them as a team. Like, the record fits because I don't know if they're good. I don't know if they're bad. They could run the table over their final six games, I guess. That's within the range of possibilities. They could split again. They could lose them all. And none of those outcomes would really surprise me that much.
No, not at all. I think this team is probably as much of an enigma as just about any. You know, obviously, it's some bad, bad losses for them. They fell at New Orleans a couple weeks ago, gave up 50-plus points. But then they go and, you know, basically are 5 seconds away from beating the New England Patriots in New England. So not a team that we know a ton about. Chiefs 29, Broncos 13. I mean, there's really only one story from this one, and that was Peyton Manning.
Man, like because this game was not on where I was eating dinner, I didn't get to see this. I was shocked tracking it on my phone. I mean, Peyton Manning has a torn plantar fascia in his foot.
What is that, by the way?
It's I believe it's one of the ligaments that goes under like the arch of your foot.
So that doesn't seem like it would feel very good.
It would feel awful to tear that. And the only way it's ever going to heal is if it's torn. Like if you have it and it's like strained.
Well, it's one
or
of those things. This happens. This is common in NBA players where like you can't just sit out a game. You know, it's
right.
Like it's basically you can play through it as much as you can with the risk of further injury, or you can sit out like multiple weeks and then it seems to clear up a little bit.
So yeah, I think it might be a tendon because it gets inflamed. You get plantar fasciitis a lot. It means there's inflammation in there, so it's very sore, very swollen normally. A tear is the ultimate result of playing through it when you've got the inflammation, and the tear is the only way it ever starts to heal. It doesn't really ever fully heal unless you tear it. When you have the surgery to repair it, they actually tear it and repair it that way. So it's one of those things that could easily be the end of his career. This is on the day he broke the all-time yardage record, was benched, possibly to end his career. I mean, like, that's...
Is it really... Are we that to that point? You know, I couldn't really tell... you know, obviously, there's a lot of reaction. This was the main story of the late games on Sunday. And it was tough to tell if people were saying he should be benched for his play, he should be benched because of the injury. Was it kind of a mixture of both? I didn't get to watch this game either. I was focusing more on the... on that New England game.
Well, Gary Kupiak came out afterwards and kind of took responsibility for it and said, I probably shouldn't have started him, because he came up on the injury report earlier in the week with two different injuries. One was the ankle, I think, and the other was like a rib injury that popped up. Manning didn't blame the injuries for his performance afterwards, kind of took the high road, as you'd expect. Peyton Manning's like a robot who just says what he's supposed to say. Like, he's pre-programmed to answer press conference questions flawlessly, because that's just what he does.
He does it in a way, though, that's a little more humanizing than a lot of guys. Like, I think he's very, very savvy with the press. He's not a complete robot up there.
No, yeah, right. But he'll still always say the right thing.
Right, yeah. He says the right thing, and I think he genuinely means it most of the time.
Or he sells it really well. Either way, I mean, for a guy to break the all-time yardage record on a day where he throws, what, four picks and had like 30 yards or something?
5 for 20?
Awful. Awful day. It'd be a really sad way for his career to end if that's what it is. How much of his struggles are the result of his health, his failing health?
It's close to 100%, right? I mean, this is Peyton Manning. I mean, this isn't a guy who just got worse as an overall football player. I mean, it's very clear that I think the age maybe more than anything has something to do with it. We kind of forget about the neck surgery that just about ended his career 3 or 4 years ago. And that's, you know, obviously he's a few years removed from that, a few more just general aging, I think. And I don't think he's gotten worse as a football mind. You know, his decision-making has looked questionable because he's throwing these horrible interceptions on what look like terrible throws. But they're also throws that Peyton Manning 2 years ago was probably making. And I think it's hard to accept that. I think we're seeing the same thing, and there was a couple memes of this, of Peyton Manning's face photoshopped onto Kobe Bryant's body and vice versa. But it's kind of the same type of thing. If you watch Kobe at all this year, I mean, he's been terrible, but he's not necessarily making bad plays. He's just like missing shots that he normally would make. And I think Peyton's kind of in that zone too, where I think he has to finally accept, like, I can't fit balls in where I used to be able to, even if they, you know, they're not necessarily bad decisions. He's just not able to execute the decisions that he would normally be able to make.
Right. The game as you see it, like, he still sees it as well as he ever has, or maybe even better because of the experience, and yet physically he can't play into what he sees, which is...
And it's killing Denver, obviously, at this point.
Horrible.
Do you think they have to go to Osweiler?
I don't even know if they have a choice. I mean, physically, Manning might not be able to play. Like, that's the big question.
At some point, if it gets to, you know, Manning is so immobile and takes a hard hit, and, you know, then it gets almost to the point where, does John Fox take blame for that? Or, excuse me, not John Fox.
Gary Kubiak.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. And again, Dan Le Batard this morning referenced it in relation to Dan Marino, a guy who, you know, probably played a little long at the end of his career, a guy who I think they stopped letting him use audibles at one point just because it was just like you're torn between, like, it's Dan Marino. You know, you have to let him do what he wants to do. And I think Denver kind of finds themselves in that spot too, because Peyton Manning's not a guy who maybe this is what it'll finally take, but I don't think he's a guy who's going to, you know, end his career on his own. You know, he's not going to go to Gary Kubiak and say, don't start me. I think if Peyton Manning feels like he can play, he's going to play.
Right. I think that's fair. But the injury just might be the perfect out for the Broncos at this point. And it'd be an unfortunate end, but I can see that being the end.
Well, they're a team that could still make some noise in the playoffs. We've seen teams with bad quarterbacks fare well in the Super Bowl.
Defense is so good that they could probably win a couple of games, but I still don't think they can beat New England.
No, and certainly not New England, but I think they could still win a first-round game with Brock Osweiler if he manages the game well enough. And it's going to take, you know, his best effort, which is asking a lot of a guy who doesn't have much experience at all. But that defense is so good that they'll still be able to stay in games.
Well, Emmanuel Sanders had an ankle injury going into the game. He played, received four targets, didn't catch any, suffered a head injury, and then passed the concussion
protocol.
That
dude takes more hard hits than just about anybody.
He's kind of small and fast, so I think that just makes him vulnerable to getting blasted from time to time.
Did you watch the night game last night?
I did.
We'll get to this. Like, the hit that Larry Fitzgerald took, I think it was in the third quarter.
I didn't see it. I didn't even see that. I heard about it because I was kind of watching and doing a couple things at once. I didn't see that hit. You got smoked, though, based on what everyone was saying.
Absolutely. Biggest hit that I can remember in a while. And you know, they got flagged for unnecessary roughness. It wasn't really a dirty hit. I mean, Fitzgerald popped right up, as you'd expect of him. And I think he even tapped. I don't know if it was Bruce Irvin, maybe, for the Seahawks. Some linebacker. He basically tapped him on the helmet and said, good hit. But that's the NFL now. You get flagged for that, and maybe rightfully so with all the concussion issues. But I mean, any closing thoughts? Anything? We haven't really talked about the Chiefs whatsoever in this one. Charcandrick West is pretty good. 161 yards from scrimmage, two touchdowns for him. But really, this was more about Denver just playing terribly and not being able to move the ball.
Yeah, I mean, give Andy Reid and the Chiefs some credit, though. Andy Reid coming off bye weeks for a long time has been really good. And it's just, I don't know, maybe give him extra prep time. And he's one of those guys that figures out a weakness every time he's got a matchup that, like Denver. I mean, Denver's great defense, too. It's just amazing the Chiefs were able to put up to 29 points against them.
No Talib, though. That is bigger, maybe, than you might think. Losing your number one cornerback, a guy who's probably on a collision course with the Pro Bowl at this point, it causes you to shuffle things around a little bit. And obviously, they're a good defense, and that's certainly not the one thing to blame this game on, but, you know, something to note.
Talib is awesome as far as corners go right now. He's one of the better ones in the league. Just so physical, can shut down pretty much anybody. Broncos didn't run it that well. Ronnie Hillman, 11 carries, 42 yards and a TD. CJ Anderson, 2 carries, 9 yards.
I think they fell behind early. Like, they almost just kind of, it was so shocking how bad Peyton Manning played that they were, I mean, this was done. It was 10-0 KC at one point, and I think that was it. Like, there was no coming back.
I guess so, but the fact that it was 11-2 carries favoring Hillman is just another week where you're just kind of left wondering, like, what's going to happen
with the way Manning was playing. Like, you'd like to think, you know, even if they knew they weren't going to win the game, you know, they get down big early in this one, like, just run the ball. Like, clearly throwing the ball is not working. You're just giving it right back to KC. But I think this is one you kind of have to throw out if you're evaluating that running back situation. You know, a big loss to the Chiefs when your quarterback throws four picks and your offense is out of sync and you're bringing in Brock Osweiler. I don't know if you can take too much away from that. Final game from Sunday, the night game, one of the better ones. It would look like an easy Cardinals victory in the first half. A couple fumbles from Carson Palmer very quickly got Seattle back into this game and into the lead. But Cardinals able to respond and win this one 39-32 in Seattle. It's good to see Ricardo Lockett raising the sixth man flag. I'm thinking about Kristaps Porzingis. I got six man.
Seattle fans are steamed right now because they don't have basketball.
Why is the 12th man flag like a neutral, like royal blue color or like lighter blue? I guess, like, why it's not even Seattle colors. I don't understand it.
I don't know.
I hate that.
I mean,
I'm
just enjoying that they're having a down year. It makes me feel better about the Packers falling apart.
I'm neutral on Seattle as a team. Yeah, I mean, I kind of like them. I don't know. I know they, in the hearts of Packer fans, they're the enemy, but
they're one. Enemy I think number they're, one right now.
I think if you're a neutral, if you're a fan, you know, if you're a middle school kid who's just getting into the NFL, like, the Seahawks are the team you would like. They have the best uniforms in the league. They have a very visible quarterback. They have an outspoken cool defense overall, for a lack of a better term. I don't know. I think they're a fun team to like.
They got a hip running back who likes candy.
Yeah. I think they're like the Oklahoma City Thunder of the NFL.
That might be fair. But yeah, like, they're just a team that I want to see fall apart. Partially because of Pete Carroll, though. I've never liked Pete Carroll. I never liked him. Going back to the USC days, like,
he's a man.
Even going back to his time with the Patriots years and years ago.
Yeah, I don't remember Patriots Pete Carroll at all.
Well, he was brutal, but the thing about Pete Carroll is that he always looks like he just won the lottery, like, all the time. Something goes right, and he doesn't even look like he had anything to do. Napa Know How.
Napa guy knows that by the foot, there's no better ride than an old station wagon. Room for six people facing forward, two people facing backward, and a whole lot of luggage, lumber, and bicycles haphazardly strapped to the roof. If you can parallel park that beast, you can park anything. And with some quality parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep your land ship running longer, stronger. It's not obsolete. It's a rare treasure. That's Napa know-how. Napa know-how.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.